This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Today we're talking about the history of the Ku Klux Klan in Hamilton County and the rest of the state and the ways we choose to remember and sometimes conceal that history. If you have questions or comments on our show today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881. Just give your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we'll do our best to get it into the conversation today. Again, that's 866-476-3881. Joining me on Skype are four guests. Jim Madison is a professor of history at Indiana University and the author of the new book, The Ku Klux Klan in the Heartland, which is coming out this fall. Jim Madison, welcome.
Hi. Glad to be here, Matt.
Jody Blankenship is president and CEO of the Indiana Historical Society. Welcome, Jody.
Hi. Thank you, Matt.
David Highway is a Hamilton County historian. Welcome to you, David.
Thank you. Well, glad to be here.
Welcome to Brian Glover as well. He's a member of the Noblesville Diversity Coalition. Hi, Brian.
Hi, thank you for having me on your program today.
David, we're going to start with you. This is not a new story, but to lay the foundation for what we're talking about, can you tell us how these documents were found?
Yeah, basically they were found by, as they say, a local contractor who was working on a building. And he was connected to the Historical Society, and so he turned them over to the Historical Society. And we took them and didn't expect anything at first. And then, of course, the situation rapidly changed as time went along there. So
what were you doing at that time in 1995?
You said, I was actually director of the Historical Society.
Okay.
It's different than what I'm doing now. I'm county historian. But back then I was actually the paid director of the society. So.
What happened right away after they were found? What was this process?
Well, actually, we were not assuming anything was going to happen, so we were just going to quietly accept them into the collection at the Historical Society. But it changed when a local newspaper found out about it and started asking questions and actually asked for a copy of the list. They wanted to go into more detail, and we had a lot of problems with that. We weren't really sure that that was the correct thing to do. The information started to get out, and things quickly spiraled out of control.
Of course, what were on the documents?
Well, actually, that's the interesting thing. I've only looked at them a couple of times myself. They're actually nothing more than a collections of receipts from dues, that these were, you know, the payment. People paid $10 to join the Klan. So it's not the complete records. Those were thrown in the river in August of 1925, as the Klan was starting to have issues because of the D.C. Stevenson trial. So these are simply dues receipts. I have no idea why these survived and nothing else did. Somebody may have been worried about legal issues or financial issues. But literally, that's all they are, is just receipts and then cards, membership cards.
Do we know for sure that the rest was that a lot of this information was I guess literally thrown in the river?
As far as we know, there is nothing else that's turned up through the years. This is the only thing that has appeared there. And it's interesting because there's a newspaper article from 1925 talking about them dumping this stuff into the river. And it was known about because whoever dumped it in there wasn't bright enough to put a rock in the bag. And it promptly floated to the surface, and a lot of the nearby houses started picking up this material and actually reading it and finding out about it. I don't know what happened to it after that. After a dip in the river, I suspect it was just thrown away. So that's really, I think, where most of the material ended up.
So what was found in 1995, what was, I guess, the reason at the time to conceal them?
At the time, remember, you're dealing with a small town historical society that suddenly was dealing with a media tsunami. And actually, and this is as Brian and I talked about, we weren't talking to the right people. We talked mostly to the white community, most of whom said, well, no, you don't need to bring that out. Did not talk as much to the black community as we should have. And then when it became more and more of a high profile event, our only thought was just kind of to make it go away. And so that's one reason why we ended up with the decision to sort of restrict admittance or restrict people's access to the thing. So that's kind of where that came from. It was a bad decision, but it was kind of made on the fly. And since then, we've learned a lot about what that means.
Well, so, but it was certainly a different time. It was 25 years ago. Would you have, I guess, released them in a different way, I guess, in that kind of hindsight? Or would you do then exactly what you think should be done now, I suppose? How has times changed to affect that decision?
Well, the nice thing is now we have things like the Noblesville Diversity Coalition that is an organized group that we can talk to that can give advice and kind of suggest and do things like that. We were literally flying on our own at that point in time. We had no clue what we were doing, among other things, as far as the big event goes there. And although I think if it had been lower profile, we might have made a slightly different decision. There was still some pushback from the white community. There was some pushback from the African-American community as well. Coy Robbins, for instance, I spoke to him about it. And he said, you know, you really should open these up. I don't know if you're familiar with who Coy Robbins is.
I'm not.
Coy Robbins was born and raised Hamilton County. He's from the Roberts Settlement. He's an African-American scholar, was an African-American scholar. He died several years ago. Do you remember when that was, Brian?
I don't remember exactly when he died, but yes, he did. He did speak out on the issue, and as well as I think the some of the NAACP chapters in other cities around Central Indiana. I think they had also spoken out on the matter, recommending that those records should not have that they should have been public at the time.
So we did get feedback from the African American community.
Jim Madison, how significant was this discovery, would you say, the one found 25 years ago, from a historian's perspective?
Well, it was very significant from a public perspective, that is, in putting a very uncomfortable subject in the spotlight. It's somewhat significant from a scholar's perspective because we now have over 1,000 names of Klan members. And one of my colleagues, Alan Saffiano, has gone through and studied those names and made generalizations about the composite nature of the people in Hamilton County who joined the Klan. That adds to previous scholarship because other scholars have studied Klan membership lists in Indiana to produce generalizations in order that now we can answer a central question with a lot of confidence. The question is, who joined the Klan? Not the individual name so much as what kind of Hoosier, what type of person would pay the membership dues, buy a robe and hood, and march down the main streets of Indiana in a Klan parade? We can now answer that question.
Do we have many records, Jim, of the Klan's membership for that time period across Indiana?
We don't have them all by a far lot, but we have good records from Wayne County, from Richmond, some from Indianapolis, some from Crown Point, and then various other sorts of records that include names and also other evidence about what this organization was up to.
Well, the Klan was a political force at this time. Jim, is there any evidence of, I don't know, coercive membership? Was anyone, I guess, in a way forced one way or another to join the Klan at that time?
Well, that's a standard excuse that people later gave after they were embarrassed to have been members of the Klan, and their grandchildren and great-grandchildren say that. And in some cases, I'm sure it was true, coerced in the sense that it was good for business. It was good to belong to a very popular organization. But I'm pretty well convinced that most of the people who joined the Klan in Indiana in the 1920s joined because they believed in the central purpose of the Ku Klux Klan.
David, what was the community's reaction to the existence of these documents when they were first found?
I think surprise, among other things. Then we had, like I say, there were some people who did in fact contact us, worried that we would quote unquote reveal the names. So as a result, that was, like I say, some of the pushback that we've got. We might have overinterpreted it. is what it was. Just the I think maybe 5 or 10 people that contacted us about that. So that's one reason why we're thinking along those lines. One of the things is, of course, that is an issue is the fact that, of course, Hamilton County has undergone such a population demographic change since then. 1920s, it was one particular group of people. We've become this suburb now since the 1950s. So as a result, a lot of people in Hamilton County have no connection at all to this particular group. There's been a whole turnover there. So for a lot of the people in the area, it's kind of, in a way, nothing to do with them, except in terms of how it makes their community look, how they feel about their community. So it's kind of that thing as well.
I kind of want to get an idea of the I believe you said media circus that was happening at around that time when it was discovered and the decision was made to conceal these from the public. What was it like to deal with that?
It was like nothing I'd ever experienced in my life, because it was, like I say, New York Times, Los Angeles Times. And when the Belfast BBC called me up, I was kind of thinking, why on earth would they be interested in this information? And I'm not really certain today why, but nevertheless, they did. There was London Daily Telegraph, and I remember literally sitting in my kitchen listening to my phone ring again and again and again, as these various news organizations called up and said, hey, we would like some information about that. So it was sort of a tidal wave. And then the night that we accepted the records, and I was literally facing that curve of reporters that you constantly see in movies and things like that, I'd never experienced anything like that. So it was very different.
How was it covered?
Mostly, it depends on, there were some outlets that definitely had an agenda. Others were kind of trying to, just do general journalism and things like that. But at any rate, there was a variety of different levels of coverage there.
We'll be back with our guests after a quick break. We're talking about the history of the KKK in Hamilton County and the rest of the state. And if you have questions or comments for the show, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We would love to hear your voice in the conversation today. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about the history of the KKK in Hamilton County. Documents discovered in 1995 that showed members of the Klan in the mid-1920s were concealed from the public ever since, but now they're available. We would love your questions and comments on the topic. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. 866-476-3881. We have Jim Madison, professor of history at Indiana University and the author of the new book, The Ku Klux Klan in the Heartland, or I should say the forthcoming book, which is coming out this fall. Jody Blankenship is with us. He's president and CEO of the Indiana Historical Society. David Highway is a Hamilton County historian, and Brian Glover is a member of the Noblesville Diversity Coalition. Jim, what usually happens to documents like this in communities around Indiana and the country? I mean, are they usually concealed from the public?
That's a good question. We don't know the ones that are hidden or still hidden. I have this wonderful vision of lots of these documents coming for us still, so long, almost 100 years later. The tradition has been to want to hide them because I think most Americans, and particularly white Americans, want what I've always called comfort history. We want a history that makes us feel good. We want a history that tells noble stories of great heroes doing wonderful things. And the truth is, our history is not noble. It's not all about wonderful people. There are heroes. There are great heroes. But there are also many, many other sides to our history. When it comes to the Klan, I can recite from memory the opening sentence of my new book. And it's perhaps controversial and not really immediately understood by most people, but that sentence is that the Ku Klux Klan was as dark as the night and as American as apple pie. We Americans, most of us, most white Americans, are not prepared, I think, to accept and to fully understand that. There has been some change in recent weeks, and it'll be very interesting to see the degree to which that change is a turning point, or whether we revert to comfort history that just makes us feel good.
I guess then, is it common for these kinds of things to have controversy around them, where people argue over whether or not they should even be publicly available? How do those fights play out, if they happen
sure.
at all?
They play out often in private because good institutions don't want to air their dirty laundry. The Indiana Historical Society had a conversation about this, and I'm sure Jody can provide some information on that. It's happening as we speak around the country. We're talking about what to do with the history that makes us feel uncomfortable. And it's a very difficult thing for human beings to do because, again, we want to feel good about ourselves. That's natural. It's understandable.
What about the personal side of this, that some people living today have family members on the list and don't want that being public? How do we feel about that? Is that problematic in a way?
Well, I can sort of understand that, but there are two answers to this. One is it's almost 100 years ago, and very few people today will know that relative from 1924. More importantly, the people who joined the Klan in Indiana, and this gets to the very serious issue, Matt, the people who joined the Klan in Indiana were not, by the standards of the day, evil, nasty, horrible human beings. Quite the contrary. They thought of themselves as decent, normal Americans. They were God-fearing. They were patriotic. They were the good people in their own definition of themselves. We may not see it that way today, but they sure did in 1924.
Well, it's easy, Jim, to kind of think of the Klan today and think that maybe the Klan of today is a lot like the Klan of the 1920s. How is the Klan of today different from that Klan?
That's a very important point, an essential point of understanding the Hamilton County issue, because the Klan of today, the Klan that revived in the 1960s in Indiana, revived because of white opposition to the civil rights movement. There's a direct connection there. And they were white supremacists. And that's the only issue of consequence that they grabbed onto in the 1960s. And as time goes by, those people who claimed Klan membership in Indiana down to the present become more and more extreme in their white supremacist views. They add other subjects, other issues, of course. They're anti-Semitic, they're homophobic, etc. But at the end of the day, they are white supremacists. And I think, fortunately, they have marginalized themselves. They are marginalized. They were in the 1960s, unlike the Klan of the 1920s, which were not on the margin, they were in the center of our culture and our society in Indiana in the 1920s. They're in the center of our history. It's a very different group today, thank goodness.
Brian Glover, you're a member of the Noblesville Diversity Coalition. When did you first hear about these documents that were found in 1995?
Well, I actually found out about them in 1995. I was living in Los Angeles at the time. And my aunt, I had an aunt that also lived in Los Angeles, and she told me on an early morning while she was reading the LA Times article that was written about these records. So she suggested I get my newspaper out and read this article with my morning coffee. So I became aware of it back then, but I wasn't local then and didn't get involved with it in any way at that time. I became involved with it again in 2018 at one of our Diversity Coalition events where we were celebrating our growing diversity in the Noblesville community. And we were, I think it was David and there was someone else in the conversation. And we were talking about Noblesville's racial history. And it was one of those conversations where we were, as Jim said, it was the conversation was the comfort history that we were often ready to talk about. And I just said to David that I think it's time that we begin to talk more honestly about the history in Noblesville, not just the Ku Klux Klan, but other racial history post-Klan that we never talk about because it doesn't feel good to us. So the Klan record came up just as an example of what we fail to do when it comes to being honest about the history in our community.
How do you respond to some of those arguments, though, that have been brought, well, that were brought up in 1995, and I imagine are still held by some people, that they don't want their family members, I guess, outed over this? How do you respond to that?
Well, the intention of making the records available, you know, while I know that there may be people that want to do that, that's not what we're after. We just wanted the records to be, one, in a place where of safekeeping, where they would be available for historians and others to look at and analyze and do the proper research on, but two, be honest about it. And part of that being honest is making them public. I know that it's possible that someone might do that, but I really have never felt that the odds of that happening are very significant.
When you first,
and I don't know that the names from 100 years later are really going to mean that much. I mean, we do a lot of research at Robert Settlement on our history, and we go back 100 to 1835 in Indiana, and we find people in our family that, you know what, they're not the ones we want to brag about, but you know what, we got to be honest. You know, not everyone was, you know, was someone that we're willing to brag about, but we need to tell that story. And I feel the same way about the Klan records.
Let's go back to when you first read about it in the L.A. Times. What was your reaction?
Well, I guess I wasn't surprised. I mean, we very much knew about the Klan in the 1920s because the city of Noblesville often likes to talk about the fact that this is the place where D.C. Stevenson was convicted of his crime. And that's the part that we like to tell. I didn't know as much about how many people in the community were members of the Klan in Hamilton County until later on. But it wasn't something that I was unfamiliar with. So it was, again, it was just one of those things. I sort of looked at the time as my little town of Noblesville getting some national attention, to be honest.
David, D.C. Stevenson, that's a name that keeps coming up. And I know the story of D.C. Stevenson, but can you fill us in?
Well, as far as it concerns Noblesville, it's almost a fluke, really, because Stevenson, of course, Grand Dragon of Ku Klux Klan, rapes and murders a woman. And the thing is, he's enormously powerful in the state, and he's not going to get anything close to a fair trial in Indianapolis. He pretty much runs the city. So they get a change of venue to Noblesville in Hamilton County. I'm not entirely sure why they picked Noblesville, other than maybe just convenient distance or something like that. So, and we have, over the years, gained a certain amount of pride from saying that, yes, it was 12 good Hamilton County merchants and farmers that found him guilty and put him away. Now, of course, I'm sure Jim Madison will point out that, well, who knows what the subtext is in all of that. So, so there is some things there, but that's how Stevenson ties in there, and just the general proximity to Indianapolis. So,
Brian, I want to know a little more about the Noblesville Diversity Coalition. Can you tell us what it is and what you do there?
Yeah, I serve on the board. I'm also an officer, and we started back in 2018, maybe just a month or two before this conversation that I was telling about that David and I had, but we grew out of some unfortunate incidents that occurred in Noblesville in 2018 on Martin Luther King holiday, when someone posted made a social media post with displaying a flag with a swastika and I believe shouting the N-word, and I think that this kind of thing was occurring in our schools. Just things that were suggesting that there were racial and cultural tensions in Noblesville, and our superintendent of schools decided that, you know, enough is enough. We as a community need to come together, and we need to celebrate our diversity, and we need to take, you know, active steps and measures toward making this company more, this city more inclusive in the process. And that's what our mission is to create a community that is inclusive and recognizes that we all belong here and should be able to enjoy living in this space.
And is recognizing history like the history that we're talking about today, this discovery, very much central to that?
Yeah, it's very much a part of it. One of the things that we're doing this year is we're putting together kind of an educational series on the history of Noblesville. And part of that is looking at the history of Noblesville from the voices of those who are not heard from. So I like to say it's sort of the Howard Zinn approach to, you know, telling our local history. So we hope that it's a way to inform the community that, you know, there's more to our history than just what is shared, you know, normally when you go to local history events here.
Jody Blankenship is president and CEO of the Indiana Historical Society. Jody, can you tell us about the society and how it works with historical societies around the state?
Sure. So the Indiana Historical Society is located here at 450 West Ohio Street. We're a private nonprofit organization. And so we have a collection of about 8 million items that tell Indiana's history from long ago up until the present. And so we are actively collecting. We're always looking for new information to tell the stories of the past and the present. So that we are informed about our past and we understand how we got to where we are and we can make better decisions for the future. And we do work with organizations across the state. We have a department dedicated to field services here. So we have a staff of four who work with local historical societies across the state to provide technical services, help them do what they do better. And in addition to that, the Lilly Endowment has generously funded a grant program that we also offer to local historical societies to help them with programs, collections, facilities repairs, programs, and what have you. So we're out and about throughout the state, and we view local historical societies as our partners in trying to collect, interpret, and share Indiana's vast and complex history.
Jim, we have a question from a listener named Jen on Facebook who writes, I'm curious, was there a connection between KKK membership and the Masons? My great-grandfather, was a Mason in Frankfurt. After his death, we discovered a photo of him in full Klan robe and cap, probably taken in the early 1920s. When my mom asked great-grandma about it, she replied, oh, that's just a club he was in. Was there a connection?
Not a deep connection. They competed for the same sorts of people, actually. The Klan, in one way of looking at the Klan, the local Claverns were much like the Lions Club or the Rotary or the Masons, competing for men. And there were also, I should be quick to say, women's Klan organizations to join in social camaraderie. I have pictures of funerals of Klan members where you have two groups at the graveside. One is a group of Masons in their regalia, and the other is a group of Klan men in their regalia, all burying the same loved one.
David,
Can I add something real quick?
Oh, yeah, go right ahead, John.
Because what it is in Hamilton County, in Noblesville in particular, there was a close tie between the Klan and the Red Man's Lodge. They met at the Red Man's Lodge office, which was it's actually still there in downtown Noblesville, and in their lodge hall. And so all through their history, there was definitely obviously some close ties between the two groups, even though I don't know as Red Men. You know, that's another one of those fraternal groups, but I don't know if they ever had any political aspirations, but there was definitely ties there.
David, I want to stay with you for a second. I want to go back to 1995 when the decision was made to conceal those documents. How did people react then? And not just the community, but everyone, I suppose, who you heard from.
Nervousness. We did talk to some of the African-American community, and they were saying that, you know, you really do need to do this, and I'm sorry we didn't listen closer to them. That was a mistake on our part. But it was like I say, it was mostly just, I guess what Jim was talking about, comfort history. People were very uncomfortable with what was going to be revealed there, and they just didn't want to see that. So I don't necessarily know if there was anger necessarily. There were certainly no threats, nothing in terms of any sort of violence or anything like this. It was mostly embarrassment as much as anything else. Their vision of themselves was being challenged. And so as a result, that was kind of the response.
There's a lot more to talk about today. We'll keep the conversation going after a quick break. We're talking to a live panel today about the history of the KKK, not just in Hamilton County, where this trunk of membership cards was found, but also the rest of Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion on the history of the KKK in Hamilton County and in Indiana. And as always, we would love your questions and comments. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can do what a listener named Diane did and leave us a short voicemail with your name and where you're calling from to 866-476-3881. Again, 866-476-3881. Let's hear Diane now.
Hi, this is Diane from Indianapolis. I just wanted to mention the fact that one of the reasons the Belfast BBC might have been interested in these papers is that the Klan was persecuted Catholics, and many of whom at that time especially were Irish immigrants. And so I imagine that there's a connection to Ireland in that way. Perhaps Professor Madison could comment on their anti-immigrant stance in the 1920s. Thank you.
Jim Madison, anti-immigrant, also anti-Catholic. Could there be a connection there?
Absolutely. Diane's absolutely right. Contrary to the later Klan in the 1960s or today, the first enemy of the Ku Klux Klan in Indiana in the 1920s were Catholics. African-Americans, Jews, also on the enemy's list, but really Catholics far and away, the most dangerous threat to the American way as Klan members saw it. And of course, many Catholics are immigrants, and immigrants were second, often the same people, Irish Catholic, German Catholic. These were the people who were not 100% Americans, and that's a term that the Klan used very, very widely. We could talk about that till the cows come home. Who's a 100% American? Well, the Klan spent a lot of time telling its people who was and who was not, and Catholics and immigrants were definitely not 100% Americans.
Jim, can I actually add to that real quick?
Go right ahead.
Yeah, because that's definitely true in Hamilton County. There was a group called, believe it or not, the Junior Order of United American Mechanics. There was actually a nativist group from the 1840s that popped up again in town in about 1900, 1901. And what happened is that when the Klan came, they were primarily anti-immigrant, anti-Catholic. And when the Klan came in, they sort of faded from existence. But this is something new that I've been working on. I was going to actually pass this along to Jim. Is the fact that post 1925, post D.C. Stevenson, this group pops up again with their anti-Catholic, anti-immigrant attitudes. And as a result, we know definitely that they were here in Hamilton County and that this anti-Catholic thing was a real thing here in the county.
Jim, I want to talk about... Oh, go right ahead, please.
Quickly, there's a wonderful speech given in Noblesville in 1924, I believe, by the leader of the National Klan who comes to town and warns people against immigrants and actually says, we have his exact words from the local newspaper, that America has to build a stone wall around the nation to keep out the scum and the riffraff. That's 1924.
We have another question on Facebook. This one's from Andrew, who says, I didn't grow up in Indiana, but I've heard stories about how New Palestine was a big hub for the KKK. I've heard from people that the high school used to be named the Red Dragons or something. I wonder how much of that is true. Also, are the roots of the towns Brownsburg or Whiteland based in some sort of racism? Jim, do we have the answers to those questions?
I love those kind of questions, Matt. they're very imaginative, but I don't think there's any evidence. I've had that question often. Are the towns in Indiana with a color in them sunset towns or racist towns? And the answer is that most Indiana towns in the 1920s were sunset towns, and most Indiana towns were, if you want to use contemporary language and understanding, racist towns. So Greenwood is no different from Farmersville.
How can we compare the presence of the Klan in Hamilton County to the presence of the Klan in the rest of the state? Was Hamilton County pretty much indicative of what was going on statewide, Jim?
Yes, except that the Klan was more popular in Hamilton County. Again, we don't have absolute numbers to answer which counties had the largest numbers or the smallest, but certainly Hamilton County would be in the top percentile of Klan membership and of Klan activity, of Klan support in all kinds of ways, in parades, in a movie theater downtown that was owned by Klan members and showed 100% American films, some of them made by the Ku Klux Klan. The Indiana Klan made its own film, The Toll of Justice. So this was a very, very vibrant, popular organization in Hamilton County.
David Highway, can you tell us who Jessica Petty is and the role that she played here?
Yes. Jessica is the president of the Hamilton County Historical Society, and she's a younger person, which is great for historical societies to have because it brings new perspective and new things like that. And she's a graduate student in history and some other things like that. So that's her background. Jessica's really been the mover on this thing. I mean, Brian and I may have discussed it and said this needs to be done, but Jessica's the one who's really done a lot of the organization and contacting the folks at the Indiana Historical Society and actually bringing the documents down there. So she's been a very, very important part of the whole process here.
So, Jody, go right ahead, please.
I'm sorry. I'd just like to add one point of clarification there as well. It wasn't the Noblesville Diversity Coalition that petitioned the Hamilton County Historical Society to make this change. I mentioned the conversation that David and I had in early 2018. David is actually the one who took it to his organization and made the proposal that the policy be changed from what it is now. And while it took quite a while to do that, and Jessica was very much involved in helping to pull all that together, he's the one who made the suggestion to the to their group that it was time to change that policy.
Jody Blankenship, can you tell us about the collection itself as it is now? What will people see when they look at it?
Yes, so you can come by and take a look at it. Because of the COVID-19 restrictions and building capacity, we do ask you to make a reservation to come in and see the collection. But you can come in, and it is ordered in boxes and envelopes, and you can see everything that's available in it. So those include some native-born loyalty oath cards, membership dues cards, transcripts of dues receipts, a delinquent members list, loyalty oaths, naturalized dues information, about five or three boxes, about five folders or more of material all in all. So you can just come by and make an appointment, and we'll pull out the material and you can go through it.
How is it being preserved? I mean, are there any special measures you have to take for old paper from the 1920s?
Absolutely. So the first thing we did with this, as we do with many things, is we froze it. We have a freezer on site to make sure that if there's any insects or mold or anything like that, that can be eliminated immediately. And then after that, we have a conservation lab with three full-time conservators here who go through the items and look for things that are falling apart or in need of repair or have some issues. And so they have been going through the materials, and it is a long drawn out process. So it's not something that can be completed very quickly or easily. So they are currently and have been working to find those pieces within the collection that need repair and restoration. They've been working on that. So it is a very drawn out process. Each item is different because it's paper. and ink and other things. So there's no one way to do it, but it is a very scientific approach.
David, I want to talk a little bit about the process to make this happen, to make these documents public. What was that like to make them available?
Basically, it was just going back, reexamining what we decided in 1995, and then having the board vote, the board of the Hamilton County Historical Society vote to make them a public thing. And there was some debate, internal debate, and not everybody was still comfortable with it, but it had been 25 years. So as much as anything else, there was just the idea that it was getting ridiculous. Endlessly long. And then after some discussion, one of the things is we're a small historical society. We just can't get open that often. So as a result, even if we did make them public, it would still be difficult for people to get to them. You know, you'd have to be there on an open day or make an appointment with somebody who is really just a part-time worker. So having them go down to the Indiana Historical Society was great because, number one, they have phenomenal care that they can give to it. And number two, they have a staff that can make it available anytime that they're open. And it's very, very accessible in that way. So that is the decision that finally came about. And that's, I think, what everybody was most comfortable with. And I think it's the way it's going to make them most available and most able to be used in an appropriate manner.
Would you say that you thought about this a lot over the 23 years between 1995 and 2018 when you first kind of started officially talking about making these available to the public? Had you thought about them a lot in that time?
Obviously, it was something that did pop up on a regular basis, but it's really helped in recent years with talking to members of the African-American community, with talking with Brian, talking with members of his family, things like that, and getting that perspective and realizing just how far off base we were when we were doing that before and kind of saying, no, this does need to be addressed. These things need to be open. So it's really been the feedback that has helped kind of change that attitude there.
Jim Madison, I've got some general questions about the Klan. What happened to it over time? Was that a gradual decline? Were there significant moments that marked sort of the end of their influence and prominence?
Well, I love Hamilton County and its history, but I have to take issue with the plaque inside the old courthouse. Outside the courtroom where Stevenson was convicted, we know from the list that at least three of the jurors who convicted him were members of the Ku Klux Klan. That's a good example of the value of these lists. The plaque says that it was a rapid decline after his conviction. I believe otherwise. I've studied this deeply and think that it took a long time until really 1928 that the Klan really was almost dead, and then elements of it remained even after 1928. And of course, Klan ideals remained long after 1928.
It's interesting because I felt like I was familiar with the story of D.C. Stevenson and the trial there, but I had not heard that perspective. I had always heard that it was a rapid decline and that his accuser essentially brought him and the Klan down. That's interesting to hear. I want to make sure that we get to this voicemail from June in Indianapolis. Let's listen.
Hello, this is June from Indianapolis. I'd like to add information about how the Ku Klux Klan was the boogeyman and the entity to be feared by Black people in Indiana throughout the years. My mother is from over in the Lyle Station area in Princeton, and my father is from around Kokomo in the Black settlement. When my mother died at 80 and she had small strokes, what she reflected back on was that she was afraid that the Ku Klux were gonna get her. So the history of the Ku Klux Klan was scary and fearful to Black people in the state of Indiana. Thank you.
Jim, is that something that you would echo? Is that something that certainly seemed like the case?
Absolutely. I'm so glad we had that call. And as I said earlier, African Americans were not the first enemy of the Klan, but the Klan was brilliant at traumatizing people, at intimidating people of all its enemies. And African Americans have a special history and relationship with the Ku Klux Klan from the South in the post-Civil War era down to the present. And it's quite understandable why in African American families, old people can still tell stories and hand down stories from long, long ago about the trauma that this organization created. It's very hard to quantify that. It's very hard for a scholar to write about that. But you know, with even a little bit of research, how really important that is.
And Jim, of course, you've been digging into this. You have the book coming out this fall. How would you characterize Indiana's relationship as a state with this part of its history overall?
Yeah. Well, it's taken a long time for us to feel at all comfortable about doing that. We have over 500 official state history markers across Indiana, run by the Indiana Historical Bureau. It's a wonderful program. But there's really only one half of a marker that deals with the Ku Klux Klan. We need to mark this history in all kinds of ways, including these wonderful bronze official state markers. There needs to be one in Noblesville. There needs to be one in downtown Indianapolis where the Klan paraded. There needs to be one across the state so that young people can look and see and think about our past.
Do you think that there's, though, a healthy way for societies to remember these ugly elements of their past? Is there a right way to do it?
Well, the wrong way is to sweep it under the carpet, as we've all said. And that simply does not work. And I think the healthy way is sunlight. The healthy way is the kind of discussion that I hope Noblesville is going to sponsor in the fall, where people can talk honestly about these things and come to learn and understand from each other, from our shared experiences. And then I would say, as a historian, to read the history. There's a lot of myth out there. Most of what, I don't want to say this with arrogance, but most of what most people think they know about the Klan simply is not entirely true or is only part of the story. There's a lot of good scholarship now on the Ku Klux Klan in Indiana, not just my forthcoming book. And I would urge listeners to read. I would urge them also to make that connection. If they care about the present and the future, than to care about the past and to join the Hamilton County Historical Society, to join the Indiana Historical Society, which is one of the very, very best historical societies in our nation. Hoosiers ought to join in huge numbers these wonderful organizations.
In the last minute that we have, Jim, what is the Klan's presence like in Indiana right now?
Oh, it's minuscule. A bunch of yahoos, a bunch of people who are, some of them literally crazy, some of them not, most of them not worth our attention. However, events in recent years, in the last few years, and even the last few months, have given some of these yahoos the courage to do horrible things, to say horrible things. We've had incidents all over the state, and I suspect they're going to continue in the foreseeable future. So this, of course, is the time for good people to stand up.
I want to thank all of our guests for taking the time today. Jim Madison, who we just heard, is a professor of history at Indiana University and the author of the new book, The Ku Klux Klan in the Heartland, which is coming out this fall. Jim, thanks for your time. Jody Blankenship is president and CEO of the Indiana Historical Society. Thanks to you, Jody. David Highway is a Hamilton County historian. Thanks, David. And Brian Glover is a member of the Noblesville Diversity Coalition. Thanks to you, Brian.
Thank you.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our technical director and composed our theme. Our podcast can be found wherever you get your podcasts. We are on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.